Hello and welcome to Vintage Rock Pod Side 2, the weekly classic rock magazine-style podcast that comes out every Friday. I'm Paul Stevenson. Thanks as always for hitting play. Now, on this episode of Side 2, I spoke to a man who has literally worked with all of the biggest names in classic rock. You name it, he's worked with them, and he has a story to tell as well. Whether that's Led Zeppelin, Queen, Rolling Stones, Aerosmith, Paul McCartney, Alice Cooper, The Doors, Guns N' Roses, Bruce Springsteen, Tina Turner, U2, Jeff Beck. Honestly, the list is pretty much endless. The man is Danny Zalisco, and he's been involved as a concert promoter in the United States for near on 50 years. He's just released a new book called All Excess, Occupation Concert Promoter, and I caught up with him to talk all about it. And you know, in books where you see some quotes from people that have read it, it's usually like newspaper columnists or minor celebs, that sort of thing. Well, Danny's book features quotes from people like Rob Halford of Judas Priest and Roger Waters from Pink Floyd, which tells its own story, doesn't it? Now, the book takes you behind the scenes of the music business, on stage and off it too. It's a massive 350 pages and is literally packed with photos of Danny with every conceivable rock star on the planet. It's got 60 chapters, and every chapter being an incredible story. For instance, just picking out a few for you here. Chapter 6, DJing for Led Zeppelin. Chapter 26, Queen at the Coliseum. Chapter 40, The Grateful Dead, Why I Hate Helicopters. Chapter 44, Axl Rose, Is There a Doctor in the House? Chapter 51, Sirs, Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr. That's just a few of the random chapters I've picked out for you there. Now, honestly, it's an incredible who's who of the music business. But before we hear from Danny, a quick recap on last Monday's guest on the main show. It was a man who wowed Woodstock, leading to global fame. I spoke with Rick Lee from British blues rock band 10 Years After, which was fronted famously by the late great Alvin Lee, of course. Now, if you've not heard this interview yet, you've got to go back and check it out. There's tales of the legendary Woodstock and Isle of Wight festivals, sharing a room with Janis Joplin, getting a standing ovation in a French pub, and 50 years in the music business. It's well worth checking out. Right, so back to Danny Zalisco then. Obviously, I don't want to give away some of the bigger stories in the interview. You'll need to get the book and read those for yourselves. But we did talk about a lot of big names and how he got into the business and much more things like that as well. So here you go. Here's my chat with legendary concert promoter Danny Zalisco. I'm delighted to be joined by one of the biggest concert promoters in America. And when he says he has a story to tell, he certainly does. If I was to list just some of the names that he's worked with, I could be here all day. So let's speak to the man himself. Danny Zalisco, thanks for joining me, Danny.
It's great to be here. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. I'm very good indeed. And the reason we're speaking is because you've brought out an incredible book. It's called All Excess, Occupation Concert Promoter. Now, like I said in the intro there, you've literally worked with pretty much every big name who's who you could mention, haven't you?
You know, it just kind of happened that way. And now that it's so many years later since I started, last time I checked, it's 47 years as of a couple weeks from now. What's interesting is when I met a lot of the people who are now the biggest names in music, they weren't the biggest names in music when I started working with them. Most of them I started working with as club bands. Mm-hmm. And I was able to forge alliances and friendships and at least business working relationships with all these people over the years as they tour on one new record after another after another. And it gets to be like you know, after a while you're visiting with old friends, especially the ones whose music you really like and the ones that you've really become close with. So it's got these extra perks to it that are unbelievable.
Absolutely. And I can imagine over the fact that your 5-decade career and the fact that you have produced over 10,000 concert events across the United States of America, it's absolutely incredible. Now, obviously, in your book, you've got some huge stories of huge names. I mean, just off the top of your head, what's your favorite story that you've put in your book?
My favorite one. Well, you know, the one that touches me the most is probably the one about Brian Piccolo, the football star from the Chicago Bears, who I met as a little kid. And he helped me out with a lot of what would become my later life lessons, in the sense that he did a booking for me, just one, and then we did a couple of others later. But I asked him if he would appear at my father and son Little League meeting when I was like 11 years old. And he said, sure, I'll do that. He goes, does it pay? I said, yeah, they told me to offer you a couple $100. And he goes, get $300 and steak dinner for you and me and I'll do it. So that was like the first time I ever negotiated anything like that. And, you know, afterwards he gave me 10% of the money that he got. So I got $30 and I go, what are you doing? That's your money. He goes, no, that's your money. That's what you get when you make somebody else money. It's called a commission, you schmuck. And I said, oh, okay, well, I'll keep that in mind. And, you know, now in my business, I don't really get commissions that often. What I get is I get to take risk on whatever I agree on paying somebody, a rock star or whoever it is. I make a guarantee to them that they're going to get paid come hell or high water. And that's what I do for a living every day. We take risks, we put tickets on sale, we promote shows, and we look for a happy outcome. Once you've done it a few times like I have, it takes a little of the guesswork out of it.
So let's take us back to some of your early days then. What were the first couple of gigs that you put on that you really got the taste for it?
Well, at first, you know, it was going to concerts and being a fan. And as time went on in the early 70s, 71, 2, I got out of high school in 72. And I kind of followed my nose to San Francisco and Berkeley, because I knew that was a hotbed of music. And I was dying to be in it. For all those years I've been hearing and reading about the Grateful Dead and, you know, Quicksilver Messenger Service and the Jefferson Airplane. I love Grace Slick, Cold Blood, one of my favorite bands, Lydia Pence. And I love the whole scene that you could see and feel, you know, through the original copies of Rolling Stone magazine when it came out. It was very much a San Francisco newspaper. It covered the world, but, you know, it was based there. So they favored the San Francisco news a lot there because they had access to it. And, you know, that magazine just breathed music and lifestyle and culture and Bill Graham and hippies and pot and all the stuff that was going on. And I enjoyed the whole newscast of all those things, and I went out there and got my toe in the water and got around some shows and did little things, nothing super important. But over the next couple of years, I was, you know, around the business a lot and the inner workings of it, even though I really had very little to do with anything other than that I managed to be in the right place at the right time sometimes. And one thing led to another. I gathered a little bit of money together from some friends and my dad, and I got my first shows off the ground. And the first one that I ended up putting on was on June 2nd, 74, and it was the Ma Vishnu Orchestra, just a fantastic 23-piece band. But I didn't know there were 23 pieces when I booked them, so I booked Journey, of all groups, to open for them. And I paid Journey $500 as a guarantee. And this was going to be their first concert outside of California. And this is also my first concert. So it was, you know, it was thrilled. We were popping cherries together. You know what I mean? And after I booked it, a week or two later, I get a call from the manager of the headliner, Maha Vishnu. And he goes, is this your first show? And I said, why? Does it show? And he goes, yeah. He goes, you booked Journey to open for a 23-piece band? We're not going to move our equipment once we set it up. So you better call Journey and fire him. So I called Journey and fired him. And I wasn't happy about that at all. You see, the whole idea of being a concert promoter is not only just about making money, but it's how you get to the place where you can make some money. And the way you can make some money is by working with people before other people do. Or you find out about them earlier than other people do, and you call them up immediately. And you say, hey, are you guys touring? Because I'd love to have you here. And I'm in Phoenix, right? So I'd love to have you guys in Phoenix. And you got to watch yourself because they just might say yes. Right? Because then it turns into the money conversation. And if you guys can come to a deal, you know, if you can arrange a satisfactory deal for both of you, you're going to end up with a show. But the bottom line is, as most young promoters think or feel or fantasize about, they think that they're going to, you know, start right at the top and be able to book whatever the big band is that you really like. And what you'll find out is they're going to say, we need to know if you know what you're doing first. You're going to have to work with some of our smaller, newer bands first and work your way up to that. And, you know, within a couple, 3 years, some of those groups that you book, they're going to get big if you do your job right in your market. And then you can bring them back and play a bigger place and really make some money. But in the meantime, book the smaller bands and get your legs underneath you and do a good job. And we'll notice. We'll pay attention. Well, I did that, and I did that, and I did that, and I did that. And here we are talking about it 47 years later.
Absolutely incredible. As we said as well, 10,000 concerts. You did mention that you kind of started by booking with the bands before they became famous and picking ones that are going to make it big. But there was one story in your book, a famous missed opportunity that you didn't follow up with a certain Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham before they hit the big time, wasn't there?
Well, yeah, that was a big missed up on my part. It happens, you know.
I mean, yeah, of course.
Like I just said, you call people up and you start asking these questions, and the next thing you know, they're available, and you work out a fee, and all you got to do is, oh, okay, let's go. That's all you got to say. And then you're on your way, and you start promoting. You get the tickets on sale, and you try to sell as many tickets as you can. In this case, and I also had Dan Fogelberg and Jerry Riopelle, which were all three were great big stars here. I had them all set up for $4,500 for the three of them, $1,500 each. Wow. And all I had to say was okay, and I would have had that show, and I would have had my first sellout in my hands, and I blew it. Anyway, I ended up becoming friendly with all three groups, and I did many, many shows with all of them later in as life went on. But you know how they say you never forget your first?
Yes.
Well, I never forget my first stupid thing. And that was stupid.
Absolutely. Just picking through the book then, there's some wonderful stories in there. Like we said, there's 60 chapters in there. So there's so much to read. There's so many incredible stories. So I'm just going to pick a couple out if you don't mind. You tell us a story about the night with Guns N' Roses and Metallica. When you were turned away from the venue.
Well, yeah, we originally had the show booked at Sun Devil Stadium, which was the only stadium here in town because we didn't have a baseball park yet. You know, the football team was playing in Sun Devil Stadiums. They didn't have their own stadium at that point. So this is the only place that show could play. And I had the show held and agreed to be held by the university on their calendar for months. So what happens is, when you want to do a show, you hold the facility. And by saying hold it, I don't mean in your arms, but you call somebody up and say, put my name on your calendar for this date and that date and whatever. And they put it down. So when you're ready to confirm the show and say, let's go, we're ready to go on sale, they're already prepared for you. It's not anything new. So when I called back to say, let's go on sale, they said, oh, sorry, we're not going to do that show. Huh? What do you mean? I've had the show, I mean, and I kept in touch with them. It wasn't like I went away for a month or two and they didn't, you know that I was still doing it. But I called them up to get it going, and they said, it's a school night. I said, why did you let me hold that date to begin with? It's always been a school night ever since I scheduled the date. You're supposed to be an institution of higher learning, and you're acting awfully stupid. So it didn't matter what I said. So I ended up calling Phoenix International Raceway, which is the place that holds like 100,000 people on the west side of Phoenix. And that's where they do all the NASCAR races. But it's rarely used for concerts, like never. And the guy out there knew that I was stuck. You know, unfortunately, I told him about not getting ASU. But instead of feeling sorry for me and making me a super great deal, he charged me more. But I was stuck. I had to do this show. So I did this thing out on the oval of this raceway. And then what happened was, to double down and make it even worse, it would have been okay. But what was worse was, there's a river and it goes east and west. And when we get too much water in the mountains, they release the dam. And the problem is when the dam gets released and there's way too much water, this water was so intense that it would blow out bridges that it passed through. And the water would get so high, the bridges would fall down. So it turned out that there was only one or two streets that you could get across this river to get to the other side of the valley. Now, in the year 19, I think it was 91 or 92, there was probably half as many people here then as there are now. I mean, if it happened now, it would be a disaster. People would be renting helicopters to get to work. You know what I mean? it was a travesty. So I was promised that they were going to let me have the traffic flow go through this two lanes. It was just one lane going each way. But for the entrance to the place, they were going to close off the road just for concert traffic. I get there to the show and nothing's closed. And they refused to do it. And they said, oh, sorry, they wouldn't let us do that. So, I mean, everything that can go wrong is going wrong. I mean, here's how bad it got. This is odd, but it's true. And it's funny now, but it wasn't then. I went to the manager of Guns N' Roses and I said, we still have a line 5 miles long of people coming in. And Metallica waited an hour to go on. I asked them to wait and finally just said, come on, let's go. And this was when James had his arm burnt and they had a guitar player playing his parts for him. So they went on and they played. They were fabulous. But I'm out of my mind. I mean, I'm not having a good time. All I can see are car lights winding through the mountains. And that just means that many people are still out there trying to get in. And I had to go and ask Axl Rose if he wouldn't mind waiting before he went on, which was kind of humorous because Axl has this reputation of not going on stage on time.
Yep.
And he'd done it to me before a couple times, but we were friendly with each other. He was a nice guy. I haven't seen him in years, but he was always a good guy to me. And I've never heard anything to the contrary anyway. But anyway, the manager says, you go ask Axl. He won't believe it. So I went to his trailer and knock on the door and, hello, is Axl there? And he came out and I told him what was going on. He goes, all right. He goes, I can't believe this is happening. He goes, you're asking me to wait? He goes, I'm happy to if it's going to help. And I said, well, thanks, Axl. That's very nice of you. So he waited an hour, and actually everybody got in. But the biggest problem for me then was realizing when I went to the box office, I said, how many tickets have we sold at the door? Because I know how many we sold in advance. How many did we sell at the door? And they go like 60. And I go, what? I mean, when you sell 30,000 general admission tickets, I'm expecting 5,000 people to walk up the night of the show because that's the way it used to be back then. Mm, yeah. We barely had computers for people to go to a store and buy tickets. And we certainly didn't have our own computers to buy tickets. So now, you know, nowadays, there's hardly a time, I bet, where anybody goes to a concert without a ticket in their pocket or on their phone now. And back then, you had to go there and buy the physical ticket and put it in your pocket and have it with you to get in. Or you bought the ticket at the door. So that loss there cost me whatever I had hoped to make on the show. Everybody got paid. I don't remember what Guns N' Roses and Metallica made that night. I know it was a ton. It was a big check. But I know I didn't come out of it all right, because between the guy who rented the place to me and how much I had to pay for the show to happen and then losing all those sales, it equaled the great big goose egg as far as making any money goes. But, you know, the bottom line is you live to see another day, and things always look better in the morning. And the other thing that I always reminded myself was, we don't settle our careers on one night. We do it year by year. So at the end of the year, I've generally always turned out okay. And the bottom line is when you're booking a lot of shows in any given city, you can afford hiccups or some beatings or losses. They're bound to happen sooner or later. You can't win on everything. But if you're doing all the good shows, you can afford to take those hits. And that's part of your responsibility as a local concert promoter. You don't start whining out loud in public about how you're getting beat up on things. You just quietly pay everybody and take your take your licking and move on.
Now, just moving on to something else that's in the book. I mean, you grew up as a big fan of the British bands, the British Invasion, that sort of thing, and you ended up working with the very cream of the crop, that the top of the tree sort of guys,
you know,
Paul McCartney and Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and so many others as well. Now, I was reading about that you've met, obviously, and worked with Paul McCartney many times. And what was the deal with the backstage issue then? Because you set up a backstage with a Wild West theme for him, didn't you? What was the story behind that?
Well, this is at the Sun Devil Stadium where I couldn't do Guns N' Roses. Apparently, Paul was on a weekend. I was talking with the manager, Paul's manager at the time, and, you know, I showed him the backstage, and it looked horrific. It was, you know, just cement and walls and asphalt, you know, the bottom of the stands. And, you know, there's nothing endearing about the backstage, and this is a Paul McCartney show, and everybody's there for the whole week. They set up in advance, and I wanted to make it a little bit more charming. So I talked to the manager, and he said, fine, let's put $5,000 in the show cost, and let's decorate backstage. What do you want to do? And we ended up deciding on a Western theme. It turned out beautiful. We got bales of hay and grass everywhere, got some horses, some mules, somebody to clean up after them, and we decorated the walls, and it looked like a little Western village back there. And I know they're on the internet somewhere, but Paul and Linda ended up doing a couple of photo shoots because they liked it so much. It reminded her of Tucson, where she had a home, and you know, it was very nice for them, and they really enjoyed it. They were super, super sweet people, and I enjoyed working with them very much. I enjoyed Linda very much, actually. She was, I could see why he was so smitten with her. They got along so well, and they made some nice kids. And later that year, I got to go to a private party where Paul was being feted for a number of awards from the Guinness Book of World Records, including that show that he did in Brazil then, where he drew almost 300,000 people, which was the world's largest concert by a solo star. And I brought a plaque for him that I have my own copy of, and I know he has his too. But it was for the fastest sellout in the stadium's history, and he really enjoyed getting that. I mean, He's one of those guys, just like any other regular person, where he doesn't look for people to compliment him, but, you know, people just have a way of doing that when they're around him, and telling him how fabulous he is and everything. And I enjoyed going there and pointing out to him that it was really a great achievement. I don't care who you are, it's a great achievement. He was so happy to see me, and like, you came all the way here to tell me that? And show me this and give this to me. I go, yeah. And he goes, that's fantastic. You know, he loved it. And the great thing was, it was right at Christmas time. And I'd never been to London at Christmas time. I'd only been there once before. And I've never been there at Christmas time since. But it's a beautiful city. And I just love it over there so much.
It absolutely is indeed. And just quickly mentioning on photos then, you mentioned the backstage photos there with Paul McCartney, but your book is really, the photos are really, really integral to it. It plays such an important part to it. And there's hundreds in there, and there's photos with you with pretty much everyone you can think of. I mean, where did you get all the photos from? I mean, did you have them kept in boxes under your bed, or did you have to go hunting for them? Or how did you come across all these photos?
All of the above. They're everywhere. Some of them are in frames on the wall. Some of them are in books. Some of them were still in the show files. A lot of them, you know, since we've had computers for a few years now, somehow they made it onto there, and we were able to transfer them. But that was one of the hardest parts of finishing the book, was not only finding all the pictures and making sure we didn't leave any out. And I did, by the way, there's so many more. I did my best with the room that I allowed myself. I cut it off at about 350 pages. I could have gone 500 so easy, but I'm going, Jesus, that's enough. I mean, 350 pages. You know, and the one thing I did, and I appreciate the comment about the photos. What took a longer time for me to finish the book was the fact that, I wanted to insert the pictures in each story where it belonged in the story. And that's what I ended up doing. But everybody was advising me against that to say your costs are going to skyrocket. It cost me almost 25% more to do it the way that I did it, because I wanted the pictures to help tell the story while you're reading it, so you don't have to stop and go look for a photo section to see if I even put a picture of somebody in there. So it ended up working out very nicely in that the story is so clean as to how I was able to tell it, because all those pictures are there to help the reader and the writer, have everything together. And I love that.
Absolutely. 100% agree. I mean, your book, Danny, is phenomenal. As you said, it could go to 500 pages. Maybe that's for the sequel. And it contains stories about some huge artists and some incredible stories. It's also got some very heartfelt and personal stories in there too. But just to cap up and finish off now, I mean, your book can be found on pretty much all the usual places, can it, Danny, on Amazon and that sort of thing, yeah?
Yeah, I have a Kindle, and the book version is available on Amazon. And if you want to get it from me directly, my website is called dzplive.com. And I would be happy to sign and send it out in our own unique way.
So, yeah, the book is absolutely phenomenal. As we said, we've just touched on a couple of the stories. It literally is just a couple of the stories. I mean, some of the other ones, just highlighting off the top of my head, there's what happened when your first big arena show was cancelled on the night by Bob Seger. And then there's you on stage having to take Mike Tyson off at the request of Whitney Houston. There's meetings with Pink Floyd in a castle with champagne girls. And the fact that you had a hand in naming Lollapalooza with Perry Farrell. And it's just an absolutely phenomenal story. And like I said, the pictures in there are well worth the book alone as well. So Danny, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, and I recommend everyone go out and get All Access Occupation Concert Promoter. Thanks for joining us, Danny.
I really appreciate it, Paul. Thank you.
Definitely check out the book, All Access Occupation Concert Promoter. It's got some fantastic rock and roll stories in there. Now, a quick recap on the competition that's running, Stone Dead Festival. They've kindly given me 2 tickets to give away, weekend passes plus camping, for this year's event in August. Now, to be in with a chance of winning, go to my website, vintagerockpod.com, and click on the Win Stone Dead Tickets link at the top or in the menu, and you've just got to answer the ridiculously easy question to get yourself in the draw. Entries close at midday UK time on Sunday, the 23rd of May 2021, just in case you're listening to this in the future. And while you're on the website, vintagerockpod.com, take a look around, sign up to become a VRP VIP maybe, and there's much more on there as well, like information about my syndicated radio program called Vintage Rock Show, yes, clever, which is played every week on stations in England, Scotland and Spain as well. Right now, back to Side 2, and it's time to look at some of the more interesting stories involving classic rock stars in this week's Classic Rock News with our good friend, music journalist with Record Collector Magazine and Universal's YouDiscoverMusic.com, Tim Peacock. And it's the news time, and the only way we can do the news is by speaking to somebody that knows all about the news, and that is, of course, author and journalist, Mr. Tim Peacock. How are you, Tim?
Good evening, Paul. I'm fine, thanks. Yeah, doing okay. There's always stuff going on in the rock and roll world, isn't there? So, you know, doesn't sleep.
There certainly is.
Doesn't sleep for the likes of us, does it?
Not at all. Okay. What have you got for us this week, then, Tim?
Okay, mate. Well, as usual, it's the fairly eclectic bag of stuff. First one actually is kind of linked to one of the stories last week. It's again about an Iron Maiden story. Again, we were talking about the new lager that they're going into business with last week. As that happens, their Trooper beer, the one they're famous for already, is actually celebrating its 8th birthday today, and they've released information to say that it's actually sold 30 million pints in that time globally.
Wow.
So yeah, Maiden and Robinson's Brewery is celebrating 30 million Trooper pints sold around the globe during the week they marked the 8th birthday of their hugely successful collaboration. So it's been going since 2013. And it's won multiple gold medals at various different British Bottlers Institute Awards and various World Beer Awards. But apparently it says, despite the pubs being closed for the early part, most of 2020, Troopers continue to enjoy strong sales online. So obviously they've adapted that. And they've also got a couple of new flavours, which is their Fear of the Dark and the Trooper IPA, which is the one we were talking about, that's a version of the last week we were talking about. So Bruce Dickinson himself says, I couldn't be proud of what we've achieved with Robinson's in reaching the 30 million pints milestone. We developed a family of outstanding Trooper beers that our fans and beer drinkers all over the world enjoy, which tells you a lot about the quality, originality, provenance, and distinctive character exhibited by every Trooper beer. So they're pretty happy. That's actually good news for Maiden fans because, of course, this week there's been a lot of speculation they didn't get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this week. Yes. So a few people like Gene Simmons from Kiss, some quite big names, have been coming out in support of them. Personally, I think actually they should have got in. I know there's a lot of different criteria here, but I think, I mean, they are a pretty seismic band, really. and I think, you know, their contribution has been pretty enormous to the metal and hard rock world in general, but maybe they'll get the nod next year. In the meantime, they're keeping us busy with not so nice beers anyway, so.
Absolutely, yes. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it's an odd one, isn't it? Because they don't always stick to just rock and roll, do they? And it's just strange that there's some people they do allow in, and strange that people they kind of leave off the list. And there's been many other big name bands as well that haven't got into the Rock Hall as well. So it's an odd one, especially for us, I think, over here in the UK and Ireland. It's seen as something, as a bit of an enigma, isn't it? It's this big, posh, lavish thing, but then you hear a lot of detractors to it as well. And yeah. I know it's seen in two different ways in America as well. So it's very different.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things about it. I mean, also the simple fact it's in Cleveland yeah. Ohio. I mean, it's not actually in LA. Now, normally these things would be LA or New York. Just generally, they would gravitate to one or the other. So it's quite interesting about that. And as you say, I mean, this year, without wanting to go into too much, I mean there's bands like, for example, Kraftwerk. I know it's not really what we'd normally talk about on you know, Vintage Rock Pod, yeah. But I mean, you know, I think it's the sixth time of asking before they've got in. And I mean, whatever you think of electronic music, they're undoubtedly one of the innovators, yeah. Really. And I mean, your pioneers, and they really should have been in a long time. But it seems to me that I don't really understand. I mean, there's fan votes with some of them, and sometimes, I mean, Def Leppard, it took Leppard a long time to get in, actually. So, you know, maybe it will happen for Maiden anyway. So fingers crossed for the boys anyway.
Fingers crossed indeed, yep.
Okay, right, well, my second one tonight, I actually just touched on Def Leppard coming to my second story tonight, Paul. Okay. The one of the biggest tours that's been advertised over the last couple of years is Leppard with Motley Crue, Poison, Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. Now, it's going to be a major, it's going to be a major blockbuster, but it's been postponed again to 2022. Obviously, the usual COVID-related reasons. Vince Neil from Motley Crue, actually, he announced this on Instagram. He says, the statement reads as follows: to all our loyal fans, we wanted to let you know that we learned today the tour is getting moved to 2022. This is the only way to ensure we can play all of the dates for all of you who have purchased tickets. We appreciate you hanging in there and can't wait to get back on stage and bring the stadium tour to all of our fans. It's going to be one for the history books. They're just referring to it as the stadium tour. Yeah. And I must say, to be honest, Paul, it does look like it's going to be one of the biggest ones ever. I mean, they're certainly going to want to go ahead, because according to the information I've got, the tickets for it, they've already grossed over $130 million. You know, this is from advanced tickets sold. Wow. I mean, there are VIP seats and there's various things, but I mean, it's a huge amount of money. So it's going to be a really big one, I think. But anyway, it's going to kick off on June the 16th next year now in Atlanta, Georgia, and it's set to run through to September the 7th, where it should wrap in San Francisco. So any Vintage Rock Pub fans in North America, I would say that's definitely a tour that you'd probably be interested in anyway. So
absolutely, yeah, so, definitely.
Okay, that's the second one. So from entirely different, the final story tonight, but one for Pink Floyd fans, and most specifically for Syd Barrett fans, actually, because interestingly enough, one of, and there's not many of them out there, still life painting by the teenage Syd Barrett is actually due to go up for auction on May the 27th. It's been revealed today. Okay. Thing about that is that, like, obviously, everyone remembers Sid's brief but mercurial career, but when he pretty much withdrew, if you like, from professional life and went back to live quietly in Cambridge, painting was kind of his first love, and he went back to that I don't know if you've read, there's a book by, there's a Sid biography by a writer called Rob Chapman called A Very Irregular Head, and he talks about Sid, and the thing about Sid was apparently when he actually, he did lots of paintings in his latter years, but he would only do them really for his own edification, and he'd photograph them, and then he'd actually often destroy quite a lot of them. So the interesting thing about this one is it was one he painted before he was in Floyd. This is when he was only 15 or 16. It was actually painted in 1961, and it's signed by R. Barrett because he was Roger Keith Barrett, was his Sid's real name. Anyway, it's been put up for sale by a childhood friend of Sid's called Phil Harden, who told The Observer, I've lots of happy memories, including watching the first Doctor Who series from behind the sofa together with Sid. The Sid I remember is a different, younger person, and I know a lot of the fans who feel even more about him who might give this painting a home. Phil Harden's father was an art teacher in Cambridgeshire High School for boys, and he actually taught the young Sid. And Phil said he was a funny and lively boy, but also very protective as me, as I was 6 years younger than him. It's amazing to me that he's still so highly regarded across the world. So I'm often putting these things off out to Vintage Rock Pod fans, Paul, but have you any idea? I'll tell you in a second, but just have a guess at what the reserve on the painting is, just to see if you've any idea.
Crikey. I'll be honest, I'm not an art aficionado, so I'll hazard a guess at $10,000.
Actually, you'd be pleased to hear it's less than that. The reserve is between three and five, actually, interestingly enough. Okay. But I think probably will go. I mean, it's out of my price range, to be honest, but if you did have deepish pockets, I mean, there are worse things out there you could be. It's quite interesting. It's a bit kind of Van Gogh-esque. I've seen a picture of it. It's going through an auction house called Sheffins, Cheffins, Sheffins Auctions, and it's the 27th of May. So if you have a look at the valuers, just have a look at Sheffins. If you just put that into Google, you can see pictures of it, and they talk of the reserve and so forth. So, and you can bid us online, as far as I'm aware. I think the bidding is due to start shortly. Anyway, for Pink Floyd fans with a bit of extra cash out there, that would be something pretty rare to get, because there's not many genuine Sid Barretts.
Very unique.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Anyway, so that's one to think about this week. That's where the news is going this week, Paul.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Tim. I'll get saving up and see what I can bid.
Maybe we do it between us, eh?
So we're up to about £23 then. There we go.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks, mate. Anyway, that's great. That's
perfect, Tim. Thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome, Paul. Thanks again.
Fantastic stuff from Tim, as always. Now, a quick shout out to say, don't forget to check out the big interviews that are released every Monday by Vintage Rock Pod. The next episode features a member of one of the early, most influential British punk bands of the 70s. They were the first British punk band to release a single, the first to release an album, the first British punk band to tour America, and much more as well. Don't miss the stories about the punk movement and the big players involved, you know, Malcolm McLaren, Sid Vicious, and much more. So don't forget to listen out for that. And go back and listen to some of my previous interviews as well, with some huge names chatting in depth about their careers and the earlier episodes, and you can download or stream now. Now, don't forget to follow us on all the social media channels as well. Just search for Vintage Rock Pod on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Give us a like and a follow on there. And that's it for this week's Vintage Rock Pod Side 2. Another Side 2 episode will be released every Friday, and you can catch up with more kind of random stuff. We have authors, and we have rock stars themselves, maybe ones we've already had on the main show, maybe coming back just to give us updates on what the career's doing. We speak to radio presenters, we speak to social media people, we speak to lots of different random people that love rock music, just to bring you a different side of classic rock. Until the next episode then, if you come across anyone who isn't a fan of rock music, just tell them, my music is better than yours. Take care.